So for this week's Dhamma talk, we're having a look at the Dakina Vibhanga Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 142, the discourse on the analysis of offerings, and this week we're also able to benefit from the bilinear translation by Venerable Ananda Jyoti, as well, of course, as relying on Venerable Analio's comparative studies as usual. The Dakina Vibhanga Sutta, as well as giving an analysis of the various kinds of merit which come from making various offerings, is also significant in that it's one of the very few canonical accounts of Mahapajapati, and particularly just about the only account of Mahapajapati as a laywoman. Excepting, of course, from the time when she was asking for ordination. And so the text has a quite significant, is one of the half dozen or so really significant passages in understanding the question of the origin of the Bhikkhuni order. This particular sutta has a large number of correspondences. As you can see, as usual, we have a corresponding sutta in the Madhyama Agama of the Sarvastivadins, and in addition, we also have a corresponding sutta in an independent translation in the Chinese canon. In addition to that, we have two other accounts which... I'm just looking for the details of this. Okay. So these ones here, which is Taishul 202 and 2. There. I'm just looking for Analia's remarks. Okay. 265. Okay, so this is these references here are to the Mahishasaka Vinaya version. I'm not sure if that's correct. Analio here has slightly different references. This is also a Vinaya text, so this would be Mulasarvastivada Vinaya, I believe. Sanskrit fragment. There's also a Gandhari fragment, partial parallel in a Uyghur fragment, and Tibetan. So not only a large number of fragments, but also one of the most linguistically diverse of all the fragments. I don't believe, actually, that all the parallels here on Sutta Central are, in fact, all the extant parallels. When it's in the Mahishasaka Vinaya, it's part of the same narrative as when she's asking for ordination. Mm-hmm. And I'll talk about that more a little bit later on. So there are really two quite distinct portions in this sutta. The first part is the story of Mahapajapati coming to offer robes to the Buddha, and the second part is the Buddha's analysis of offering, where the Buddha discusses with Ananda and Mahapajapati is ignored. Let's have a look at the sutta. Thus have I heard, at one time the Gracious One was dwelling amongst the Sakyas near Kapilavattu in the Nigrodha's monastery. Then Mahapajapati Gotami, having taken a new pair of robes, Navanglusa Yugam, approached the Gracious One, and having approached and worshipping the Gracious One, she sat down on one side. While sitting on one side, Mahapajapati Gotami said this to the Gracious One: "This new pair of robes, Venerable Sir, is for the Gracious One. I cut them myself. I've sewn them myself. Please accept this from me, Venerable Sir, Gracious One, taking compassion on me." After that was said, the Gracious One said this to Mahapajapati Gotami: "Give them to the Sangha, Gotami. When you've given them to the Sangha, you will have offered them to me and the Sangha." Okay. Notice the word he's translated as offered here is pujito. Perhaps better to say respected or shown reverence for both me and the community. And for a second time, and for a third time, the Mahapajapati continued, and the third time the Buddha refused, just like when she asked for ordination. And also, just like when she asked for ordination, Ananda interfered. After this was said, Venerable Ananda said this to the Gracious One: "Please accept, Venerable Sir, Gracious One, the new pair of robes from Mahapajapati Gotami. Mahapajapati Gotami, Reverend Sir, has been a great help to the Gracious One. As mother, sister, foster mother, stepmother, wet nurse, when your mother passed away, she suckled the Gracious One with the mother's milk. Also, the Gracious One, Reverend Sir, has been a big help to Mahapajapati. Because of the Gracious One, Reverend Sir, Mahapajapati Gotami has gone for refuge to the Buddha, to the Dhamma, and to the Sangha. Because of the Gracious One, Reverend Sir, Mahapajapati refrains from killing living beings, refrains from taking what has not been given, refrains from sexual misconduct, refrains from false speech, from liquor, wines, or intoxicants that cause heedlessness." So we have here the help that the Buddha has given to Mahapajapati. Starts out with going for refuge and then the precepts. And because of the Gracious One, Reverend Sir, Mahapajapati Gotami is endowed with perfect confidence in the Buddha, Avecha Pasadena Samanagata. Is endowed with perfect confidence in the Dhamma, is endowed with perfect confidence in the Sangha, is endowed with the virtue that is agreeable to the Aryas. Of course, these being the four factors of stream entry. Because of the Gracious One, Reverend Sir Mahapajapati has no doubt about suffering, has no doubt about the rising of suffering, has no doubt about the cessation of suffering, has no doubt about the practice leading to the ending of suffering. And this, of course, also reinforcing the fact that she's a stream enterer, the attainment of being beyond doubt about the Four Noble Truths being, again, a characteristic of stream entry. The Blessed One has been of great help to Mahapajapati Gotami. The Buddha replied, "Just so, Ananda, just so, Ananda. For the person, Ananda, who because of another person has gone to refuge to the Buddha, the Dhamma Sangha, it's not easy for that person to be repaid by the other person that I say, by the other person. That is to say, with worship, rising from one's seat, reverential salutation, homage, gifts of robes, arms, food, dwellings, and requisites of medicine for support when sick. For the person, Ananda, who, because of another person, has refrained from killing living creatures, from taking what is not given, sexual misconduct, false speech, and from liquor and intoxicants, it's not easy for that person to be repaid with worshipped and gifts. And for the person who's endowed with perfect confidence in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and the virtue that's agreeable to the Aryas, it's also not easy for that person to be repaid with worship, homage, and for gifts. And for the person who's, because of another person, has no doubt about the Four Noble Truths, then it's not easy for that person to be repaid by another person with worship, rising from one's seat, reverential salutation, homage, gifts of robes, arms, food, dwellings, requisites of medicine for support when sick." Well, it doesn't say you can't, it just says not easy.
I'm getting confused between which person is which person. Mahapajapati repaying the Buddha?
What they're talking about here is they're saying if somebody has been your teacher and led you to taking the precepts and all of those other things and realizing the Four Noble Truths, mm-hmm. then you can't really just repay them by giving them material gifts. The two are kind of different scales, and by paying respects and giving material gifts. Now, curious thing, then it goes on to the analysis of offerings, which has its own interest, but the most interesting thing is that from then on, there's no mention of Mahapajapati.
Maybe she's
already gone
back.
No. And It doesn't also have a normal ending. The sutta doesn't have a normal kind of ending in the sense it doesn't have that then everybody rejoiced. It mentions the different kinds of analysis of offerings. And then gives a verse, like an Udana kind of verse. This is a classic Udana, Idang Vatvana Sugato Adhaprang Etadavocha Satta. And then it breaks off without any, and you know, Venerable Ananda or Mahapajapati then rejoiced in their words. So we note right from the beginning that there's a few unusual textual features here. It's certainly unusual that he should start out in a conversation with Mahapajapati and then apparently forget about her halfway and have this long conversation while she's there, and they never resolve the problem of whether the robes are going to be offered. Then you have this long analysis of offerings, and again that doesn't seem to really sort of round itself off as a coherent teaching either. So there certainly are some textual issues here. What the exact situation is of course not easy to determine. As with all things, when we're doing textual studies, it's much easier to notice when something goes wrong than it is to figure out what should go right. And I think it's not just in textual studies that's the case, right? If you're driving a car, it's easy to figure out that there's smoke blowing out the exhaust. It's not so easy to figure out why it's blowing out the exhaust and how to fix it. So maybe just to avoid unnecessarily drawing out the tension of the mystery of what actually what happened in this text. My own belief is that that this text was originally two completely separate entities. One of which was the account of Mahapajapati wanting to offer the robes to the Buddha, and the other one was a discussion or analysis on the various merits of offerings, and that these two, when the Vibhanga Vagga of the Majjhima Nikaya was formed, these two parts got put together for reasons which are somewhat obscure. But I think that the natural place where this particular dialogue actually belongs, the dialogue with Mahapajapati, is actually as a preface for Mahapajapati's asking for ordination. And we can notice, of course, a lot of points of connection between these two dialogues. The mention, of course, the basic context of it, Mahapajapati going and asking a question, and the Buddha refusing three times, and then Ananda interceding. So that basic form of it, of course, is exactly the same. More than just the basic form, we find other points of similarity between the two accounts. If here is the account of Mahapajapati's request for ordination, and after Mahapajapati has asked and then wandered following the Buddha, then when Ananda is asking for the Buddha's permission to give the full ordination to women, he starts out by asking him just directly, and that doesn't work, and so he then says, well, are they capable of becoming arahants? And then the Buddha said, yes, they can. Then he then goes on to say that Mahapajapati has been very helpful to the Buddha, that she looked after him when she was young, was his nursed him with her own milk after his mother died, and because of gratitude for that, also begged the Buddha to give the full ordination. So, of course, that's another point of connection between these two, that there's that mention of the Buddha's gratitude to Mahapajapati. We also find another point of similarity is, of course, in the Garudhammas, and one of the Garudhammas being that the bhikkhunis should always bow down, rise up, make anjali for, and so on, for the bhikkhus, And this, of course, being the same words that we found in the Dakina Vibhanga Sutta, Abhivadanam Pachyuttanam Anjali Kamang Samichi Kamang, for the talking about the that one can't easily repay. Yeah, so by worship and rising from one seat, reverential salutation and so on, I can't easily repay somebody else. Abhivadana Pachyuttana Anjali Kama Asamichi Kama. That's the same phrase here as is found in the Garudhammas. Now that doesn't prove anything, of course. It's a stock phrase. It's found in a lot of other places as well. But it is rather curious why this it appears in the Dakina Vibhanga Sutta, right? The Dakina Vibhanga Sutta so far hasn't had anything to do with worshipping, paying respects to, bowing down to, or anything like that. Suddenly that topic's introduced here, just as it's introduced in the Garudhammas. So there are a number of points of connection between this opening dialogue between Mahapajapati and the Buddha, and the account of Mahapajapati asking for ordination from the Buddha. Of course, there may be any number of explanations for that, but the explanation which I think is the simplest explanation is that these were part of the same dialogue, and that they're concerning the same themes. And essentially, I think the themes is that Mahapajapati is personally attached to the Buddha, and the Buddha is trying to stop is trying to stop her from being personally attached to him. And I think that's clear enough in the account in the Dakina Vibhanga Sutta. That's precisely what the Buddha's doing, right? She wants to give to him personally, and he's saying, no, give to the Sangha. So in effect, he's saying, you should respect the Sangha. And the psychology of that, I think, is fairly straightforward, that Mahapajapati is they call her a queen, but in any case, a leading lady of the Sakyan clan, the Buddha's mother, would have been quite an imposing figure, somebody who was used to having her word obeyed, somebody who was used to being sitting on the high seat and being respected. And she's wanting to go into a situation where she's going to be nobody, just a new nun. And so the Buddha's wants to make sure that she's going to respect the Sangha. So I think personally, I think that's all fairly straightforward. One of the other interesting details in that, which is not so obvious, is this whole question of why she's offering the robes to the Buddha. And this is something which is actually mentioned in the Bhikkhuni Vinaya, that apparently there was a custom where the students would offer robes to the preceptor before asking for ordination. And this is something which is actually referred to in the Bhikkhuni Vinaya, not in the Bhikkhu Vinaya. And it's also something which is referred to in the Dharma Shastras. So I believe, if I remember correctly, in the Manusmriti, it talks about when a Brahmanical student wants to become a student of a teacher, that there's a number of conventional gifts which they offer to the teacher, one of which is the offering of robes for the teacher. So clearly it was a custom that if you wanted to become the student or take ordination, that you would offer robes to the teacher or to the preceptor. So again, that would make perfect sense here. Mahapajapati wants to ordain. She comes along. She's Akamchi in the second ayah. She wants to ordain. She comes along to the Buddha. She brings some nice robes for him. She wants to offer them to him. She kind of suspects in the back of her mind that there might be some kind of problems, right? And so she wants to get some really nice robes to offer them to the Buddha, and she's still thinking in a kind of worldly way of wanting to butter up the Buddha and make him feel that sense of gratitude to her. And the Buddha acknowledges that sense of gratitude, but he also points out that that sense of gratitude, the spiritual gratitude from the teachings that he's given her, is actually something that's of far greater worth. So in a sense he's saying, I'm not going to give you the ordination because, you were my mother, or because you looked after me when I was young, or anything like that. But I'm only going to be he was only going to keep his focus on the spiritual side of things. And then the eight Garudhammas, and particularly the rule about paying respects to monks, makes sense as a requirement for Mahapajapati. As somebody who's very proud, with the pride of the Sakyans, that she should have to pay respects to the bhikkhus in order to reduce her pride. So this is my reading of these texts and my interpretation of them. And as I said before, this when we're reconstructing ancient texts or looking at ancient texts, then it's very easy to find fault lines and potential areas of problems. And we've already noted just a couple of very clear examples of editing anomalies already in this sutta. And it's of course much more tenuous to try to work out exactly what might have happened. But in any case, that's my own take on it. So, Ayadamananda, you can say?
I remember I did from when after Mahapajapati, Gautami asked ordination right after the husband, you think it was an adhar, and it was a Kapila Vastu, and the Buddha refused. I don't know if any relevant within the event she offered the rope to the Buddha, and in the occasion she asked, is it your first time she asked for ordination or not? She obviously make an attempt to ask for ordination when the Buddha in Kapila Vastu, right after his father that death. Yeah. And it connected with the event or not.
Which is also in Kapila Vastu.
Yeah, in Kapila Vastu.
Yeah.
And Nivatama Monastery.
Yeah, yeah, it's the same place. Right. Right.
And after the funeral, the first time she asked for ordination. But the Buddha refused to be ordination at that time. And when she came to Vaishali, it was the first time she made a request for ordination. It was the first time. So maybe this time she made an offering and she made a request for ordination, but it's not mentioned in the sutta.
I mean, clearly there is a lot of background which we don't have in the sutta. Right? The text is only gives us a few details. So what you mentioned there about her wanting to take ordination after the death of her husband is a detail found in the commentary. Sounds very plausible, right? It's a very common thing to do. Yeah, it's that if somebody's husband will pass away and then they want to go forth. So, you know, we can't be sure that that's what happened, but on the other hand, it's certainly a very plausible detail. Yeah.
Other than a typical start and finish, do you feel like there's anything in the teaching that's missing?
What, in this sutta? Well, possibly, but more in the this particular one doesn't have much in terms of the actual teaching itself. What is a bit peculiar is this thing that when she's offering the robes to the Buddha, and then he says, no, give them to the Sangha, that's the only time that this happens, right? There's plenty of other places when people come up and want to offer robes and so on, and the Buddha never makes a fuss about it. So that's only this case. I don't think that's a problem. I think it's an indication, it's a hint that there's something, you know, special going on, you know. I think that's quite a you know, an intended subtext. You're meant to notice that the Buddha's acting in an unusual way.
I was wondering how many times did you refuse anything?
From other, well, he'd have problems if there was that food that had been chanted over. A strange thing about food that was chanted over, and then he said, "I can't take that." Yeah, I think it was like kind of sacred food. Yeah, it might be like taking the Eucharist if you're in the Catholic Church that you have to take
it. I can't take it.
I don't know, but...
Wasn't there an elephant for one time? The king tried to give him his elephant.
Oh, probably something like that. So yeah, there are... Yeah, well, there are things, obviously, if there are things that are unallowable, that's one thing. Sorry? Magandhya. Yeah, Magandhya's offering, yeah.
The explanation of why...
Tried to give his daughter, yeah. Sorry?
The explanation of why seems quite thorough.
Of why what?
Of why he can't take the robes.
Uh-huh.
So that's why I was just asking if there's anything that you saw that seemed like it was missing other than the start and finish and the highlight start. Fairly clear as well.
Yeah, nothing specifically in this section. Yeah.
It seemed quite good. I mean the actual teaching itself, like, I got a fair bit from that anyway.
Hmm.
Rising from the feet and all that stuff. that sound just like the things you're supposed to do for a teacher, the duties you have towards a teacher. So I didn't see how it necessarily connected with the eight kind
of it doesn't necessarily connect. As I said, it's a stock phrase. It could be in a number of places. But when we're doing text critical studies, you never find, or very rarely do you find a kind of a magic bullet. What you find is, so you never find that one thing that tells you what the answer is. No, unfortunately not. Magic bullets are few and far between. What you do tend to find is like a collection of hints. And any one of those hints by themselves would be pretty meaningless. But when you find quite a few of them, and they all tend to support a particular hypothesis, that's when you can start to be a bit more certain about your conclusions. So, it's true. Any one of them is not necessarily particularly strong, but the collection as a whole, yeah? And, that, you know, it's just like in everyday life. If you ask somebody where's the closest Coles supermarket and someone says, oh, it's around the corner, yeah, well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But if you ask three people and they all say it's around the corner, then you can be pretty confident that that's where it's going to be. Yeah?
It's in
one of the Pachitya rules. It doesn't say you have to give robes. It gives I think it gives. I think it's one of these ones.
I'm having to give him this robe. Huh. If you give me a robe, I'll ordain you.
That's right.
Yeah, it's more like that.
That's right.
And don't ordain them. Then that's a Pachitya.
Right. So it's not that the student has to. It's just that it shows that there was a custom of doing that. Yeah.
If you attend to me for 2 years.
Well, yeah, that rule's one that always kind of fascinates me. That it's perfectly okay to be like, hey, if you give me a robe, I'll
ordain
you. Like,
right.
That's not the issue.
Right, yeah.
There.
Yeah.
It's only because I've noticed in the stories that she learnt how to sew the monk's robes.
Which, sorry?
Apparently.
She has?
Yeah. Well, I suppose it could be generic.
Yeah, it's just a phrase in Navang Dusa Yugang. It's the same phrase as like in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, of the cloth which is offered to the Buddha. The robes offered to the Buddha.
Yeah. Cotton,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Well, is it a robe or is it a cloth?
It's Navang Dusa Yugang. I think it's a generic term. I don't think it specifically means robes sewn in the monastic style. I mean, they may have been, but I don't think that phrase itself implies that. And there's plenty of cases where the monastics are taking robes from lay people, which aren't specially sewn. So
you have to cut only one of your three robes; the other ones can be left for the
upper. Yeah.
So if you have no clothes, you only have to cut one.
Yeah.
Cut your lower robe or your upper robe.
So, go on.
What about the whole commentary on story about her raising the cotton from seed and all that?
Uh-huh. Oh, I haven't read that bit. Did she?
That's what I was taught. that she sewed the cotton herself.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that she planted the cotton, harvested the cotton, did all of this by hand.
Uh-huh.
Patient.
She's why there's a sense of confidence that she was a lay woman at the time, that she was still doing those things.
Yeah, I wouldn't. That's yeah. Yeah, look, may it be so, but yeah, sounds like a commentarial elaboration to me. Let's have a look at what the comparative study has to tell us. The Dakini Vibhanga Sutta surveys the merits that accrue from offering to different kinds of recipient. This discourse has a parallel in Madhyama Agama and a individual translation. In addition, a version of this discourse is also extant in a Gandhari fragment. So this is parts of an earlier section of this discourse can also be found in Sanskrit fragments and in fragments of the Maitri Simit, preserved in Tocharian and Uyghur. Okay, so we have Pali, Sanskrit, Tibetan, Chinese, Gandhari, Tocharian, and Uyghur versions of this particular sutta.
How much of a difference for all these to be?
It should be, yeah.
identical on the...
Well, that's what we're about to find out. Most of those rarer language ones are just fragments, although are just fragments. So they're not necessarily the whole sutta. Another parallel can be found in a discourse quotation in Shamatadeva's commentary, the Abhidharma Kaushupaika Namatika. The beginning part of the Dakinabhibhanga Sutta has also a counterpart in two individual translations and in the Mahishasika Vinaya, where it forms part of this Vinaya's account of the events that led to the founding of the Order of Nuns. So notice that the beginning part is found in the two individual translations. This one here, actually two individual translations, one of which is not mentioned here. I think there's some mistake on sort of central. In any case, the important point about that is that both of those versions, they separate the account of Mahapajapati and the analysis of offering a robe. So they only have the part of the Mahapajapati part. They don't have the analysis of offering, which is quite significant. In some of the other versions, we only have, so for example, the Karoshti fragment in Tokharian, in Gandhari, only has the analysis of offerings and not the initial story. Whereas the Sanskrit fragments, the Sanskrit fragments has the initial introductory section, and the Uyghur fragment has both the introduction and the ending section. So the outcome of that is that there's considerable evidence that those two sections of the sutta may in fact come from two distinct textual streams, that they're found separately in quite a few places. Although we should note that because a lot of those sources that we're referring to are either fragmentary or quotations, that they're, of course, they could hark from an earlier version which did have the two parts together. But nevertheless, it remains the case that several of our sources present just the first part or the second part without unifying the two. So, you know, in that kind of case where you have both indications within the text itself that it's not unified, that it starts out talking to Mahapajapati and then halfway through forgets about her all the way to the end, and that there are actual texts where these two parts are separated, taking those things together is a very strong indication to me that originally these two did not form part of the same text. The Dakinabhibhanga Sutta, the Majjhima Agama version, the individual translation, the Gandhari fragment, and the Tibetan parallel in the Abhidharma Kaushupaika Namatika begin by narrating how Mahapajapati Gotami tried for up to three times to offer a robe to the Buddha, who told her to offer to the monastic community instead. This particular event is also referred to in the Mahaprajna Paramita Upadesa Shastra, so it was known in that tradition as well. The Shastika Vinaya and the two individually translated discourses that parallel only the introductory narration of the Dakinabhibhanga Sutta also report that the Buddha refused her gift and told her that she should give the robe to the community instead. So that's a very widespread tradition. The Mahishastika Vinaya and the two individual translations, the two individual translations continue by reporting that after the Buddha had refused and explained the reasons for his refusal, she attempted to give the robe to the community of monks, but none of the monks dared to take the robe until finally the monk Maitreya accepted it. And you should notice that there's some confusion in the text. There's actually one, probably more monks, actual historical bhikkhus in the early Sangha called Maitreya, And in the later texts, because of the great popularity of Maitreya the Bodhisattva, they became confused with Maitreya. So even though they were clearly just monks who happened to have that name, they were said to be the Bodhisattva Maitreya in later texts. So the same two versions then continue to relate what took place when the next day Maitreya wore the robe and went begging, so that the remainder of those two texts no longer parallel the Dakinavibhanga Sutta. And in fact, that account then becomes part of the narrative of Maitreya, and the robe sort of circulates around with Maitreya and then and Kassapa and so on, and eventually that robe's going to be preserved and then offered to the Buddha again, Buddha Maitreya in the future. Yeah, Mahakassapa is going to go and sit in meditation and keep that robe on until. So there's a kind of complex stories of what actually happens to these particular robes. Okay.
So I'm recalling that there's a commentarial, Pali commentarial story that then when the other monks turned it down and then the most junior of monks ended up with the robe, then the Buddha threw his said he was going to throw his alms bowl into the air, and anyone who could hold the alms bowl into the air, something to do, I forget the exact thing, but only that monk could do it. And then the Buddha said, this is the future Maitreya Buddha. And then the future, and then had all these arhants and monks bow to him, and then he went away and did his own thing.
That's the only thing that you can get out of that particular story. The rest of it's fine. What am I doing here? Well, the rest of it's fine. It's just that bit. Oh, that's a very interesting story. I wasn't aware of that story. And maybe it might be in the Pali commentary, but it does seem that if that's the case, then that's drawing on this similar tradition to the individual suttas that we just looked at, that we just heard from briefly in the Chinese, and that again, that being the phenomenon which we have noted before, which is that you find similar, sometimes the same stories found in the Pali commentarial literature, which in the northern literature becomes included in the text itself, although in this case not the canonical text, but later sutras or texts of some form.
I think you could do a find for
Gautami, perhaps. It's there. Dudiyampi Dehi Kada. Oh, that's a long story. Yeah, you're probably right. Yes, there is a long story here. We shouldn't go through and read it. No, it goes on to the analysis, must be up here. Yeah, I can't see the whole story there, but anyway, there is a story. It does talk about Suddhodana's. And it does bring out the pride aspect of it here. When Mahaprajapati saw the Buddha, she thought to himself, "So bhati watame puttasa atabhavo ti." Indeed, my son's body is shining gloriously. And then she had strong joy, and she thought, my son, after we went forth, he attained freedom. Yes, nothing too interesting there. So anyway, look, I'm not sure where that story come from, but it would be interesting to follow that through. Okay, back to the comparative studies. Dakina Vibhanga Sutta, Majjhima Agama Parallel, Tibetan Parallel, and the Mihishasika Vinaya report that Ananda intervened on behalf of Mahaprajapati Gautami by reminding the Buddha of her services when she acted as his foster mother after his own mother had passed away. There might be a similar mention in the Gandhari fragment, but it's unclear. The individual translation, Majjhima style translation, omits that mention. The Buddha, Ananda's reminding the Buddha of his debt of gratitude to his foster mother can also be found in a different context in the Dharmaguptaka, Mahasangika, Mulasarvastivada, and Theravada Vinayas, and in a discourse in Anguttara Nikaya together with its two Chinese discourse parallels. In these instances, Ananda's reminder had the purpose of convincing the Buddha to allow women to go forth as nuns. Placing these accounts side by side with the Dakina Vibhanga Sutta and its parallels suggests that Ananda reminded the Buddha on two occasions of his debt of gratitude to Mahaprajapati Gautami. Curiously enough, while in relation to this relatively insignificant issue of accepting a gift, Ananda's intervention was not successful, the same argument was apparently more successful as a part of an attempt to convince the Buddha to permit women to go forth, even though, according to the same sources, the Buddha presumably knew that this permission was going to considerably shorten the duration of the sasana.
Actually, the request for women's ordination was much shorter. Ananda went into the whole thing of her confidence and so forth that he didn't go into. The request for ordination is shorter than
this one. Yeah, this one was more elaborate.
Much more elaborate argument.
Yeah, and but what it does include, of course, is the mention of becoming arahants, which is not mentioned here. Yeah, actually, that particular point in the different versions varies quite a lot between the different versions. There's actually several different reasons which are given in the different versions. One of which is that women can become enlightened. Another one being the gratitude to Mahaprajapati as a mother. A third one being the fact that all Buddhas of past, present and future have had bhikkhuni sanghas. Mm-hmm. That third one is not mentioned in the Pali but is found in other sources. And various sources will have various of those three things. There's even one source, I think the Mahishasika, or one of the sources even says that past and future Buddhas did not have bhikkhuni sanghas. And that was an objection to it. So, there's those three reasons. Personally, I think, of course, that the real reason is because they can become arahants and the others aren't particularly important. But anyway,
I feel how can a Chittai, when Ananda will Subhuta ascend?
Well, this is another problem, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Because
Ananda
will can be here after his enlightenment.
That's right, yeah.
Any other monk that he ascended, not Venu Ananda.
That's right, yeah.
That's
right.
Argument that he didn't have to have been the attendant, to have been hanging around the Buddha. He's like the Buddha's cousin, maybe, or just hanging out, visiting his cousin, and he's there.
How old was Ananda?
I don't know.
That's called in fictional terminology, that's called a retcon, yeah? Retcon, retrospective continuity. It's where you have a problem with the text and then you bend over backwards to try to explain it away. I mean, clearly in these texts he's acting as a confidant and a close associate and so on with the Buddha. So yes, it's possible that there might be no problem, but it's highly unlikely. But moving on from that, it's actually not even possible, because the argument that Ananda had. Okay, so when we want to establish these things, let me just explain in more detail that point that you're saying there, because I think this is an important point of procedure apart from anything else. When we want to understand these things, we first have to recognize that our knowledge of the dating and especially the internal chronology of events in the time of the Buddha is very sparse. We don't know much about what happened. Most of what we can find out is what we're told by much later commentaries. There are a few hints from in the suttas themselves and in the early texts themselves, and surely the most basic principle is that we should not override the explicit things which were actually told in the early strata of texts, right? So we should, at the very least, we shouldn't throw out the few relatively hard facts that we have. Now, in this particular case, we do actually have a relatively hard fact to rely on, and that is the verses of Venerable Ananda in the Theragata. Oops, no, that's the Theravadana, if I'm not mistaken. And so the Theragata and Therigata, of course, being the verses of the elders, the way that they've they should list this under the names of the elders, but unfortunately they keep the traditional thing, so it makes it a hassle to try and find them. There's some ruggers. Oh, God. No. So the Theragata gives the verses of the elder bhikkhus and the here we go, Ananda Thera, that's good, Ananda's verses. And so here we have as close as we can to the words of Ananda himself in an early source, and here he actually says, if I can find the verse, he's got quite a few verses. If anybody notices the verse before I do, you win a prize. Well, he talks about how long he's been ordained. I'm not saying it's going to be a good prize, right? That's right, yeah. Okay, so here he says, Panna Visati Vasani, for 25 years, Seka Bhutasa Me Sato, I was a trainee. That means he was a stream enterer. And in that time he didn't have a sensual perception arise. So 25 years, he repeats it, he didn't have hatred arise. And then it says, for 25 years he looked after the Buddha, Bhagavan Tang Tahing. 25 years he looked after the Buddha, 25 years he looked after the Buddha. Okay, so we have that figure of 25 years. So that means 25 years from, we know the Buddha lived till he was 80, so we have the 45 years of the dispensation, so we take off that 45, the 25, so after the first 20 years of the Buddha's dispensation, he was looking after the Buddha. The other fact that we know about Ananda in the Vinaya, it says that he went forth and became a stream enterer in his first rains retreat. Okay, so we know he must have been at that time. So because he said he was a trainee for 25 years, obviously until just after the Buddha passed away. So we know that he must have ordained effectively after 20 years after the Buddha's enlightenment, and we know that fairly securely. Okay, these dates might be wrong, but they are all from early texts, and that constitutes as good as we're going to get in terms of dating. So we know that the Ananda ordained after 20 years. The problem is that the normal account of the establishing the Bhikkhuni order says that it became established when the Buddha returned to his home city of Kapilavastu after, I think it was 5 or 6 years? 6 years. Again, according to those accounts, but it can't be the case, yeah? Ananda's chronology is also mixed up. I mean, Ananda is said to be the same age as the Buddha. Obviously, he's not. He's a generation younger than the Buddha. The same day, yeah. Yeah.
But in one of the things, I can't remember identify in one of them, but it's just Ananda was one of the Shikha rings ordained together.
Yeah, that's in the...
Yeah, Shakyan rings ordained together with Nandira, Nandira, and Devadatta.
Upali.
And Upali.
Yeah.
Upali was number 7.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, that's in the Sangha Veda, yeah, Kandaka.
And,
yeah.
And they ordained about 4 or 5 years after the Buddha enlightenment.
Yeah, except it can't have been. It must have been 20 years after.
So
yeah.
It completely changed.
So we have a complex and convoluted chronology, and what we can say is that it's impossible for, or very unlikely, that Mahaprajapati, that Ananda could have been there in his role of interceding on behalf of Mahaprajapati, if it was really the case that she's making this request only 6 years after the Buddha's awakening. So there's again a number of possibilities of what might be happening. What might be happening is that the Bhikkhuni order in fact became established only 20 years after the Buddha's awakening. That's possible. Or another interpretation would be that Mahaprajapati was not the first Bhikkhuni, and the Bhikkhuni order was already established, and that the story of Mahaprajapati requesting ordination was originally the story of Mahaprajapati requesting ordination and not the story of the foundation of the Bhikkhuni order. Okay, so coming back to Venerable Anālayo's comparative study, according to the main Chinese and Tibetan parallels to the Dakina Vibhanga Sutta, in reply to this reminder by Ananda, the Buddha explained that he also had benefited Mahaprajapati Gautami, as due to him she had gone for refuge, taken the 5 precepts, was free from doubt in the 3 gems, and had acquired insight into the 4 noble truths. According to the Sarvastivadin version of the text, it also adds that she had acquired faith, morality, learning, generosity, and wisdom, which elsewhere are said to be factors of stream entry. And as Anālayo says, this listing of benefits implies that she had become stream enterer. According to Majjhima Nikaya discourse, however, it was Ananda who mentioned the benefits that Mahaprajapati had derived from her association with the Buddha. Ananda, who mentioned the different? Hang on, which one did it say here? Was this Ananda explaining the benefits of Buddha? Yeah? That's right. Yeah, and so in the Pali version, Ananda explains the benefits which the Buddha had given to Mahaprajapati, whereas in the Chinese and Tibetan versions, the Buddha explained the benefits, not Ananda. The different Vinaya accounts agree with the Majjhima Agama version, the individual translation, and the Tibetan parallel, as they also report it was the Buddha who had taken up the topic of how he had benefited his foster mother. A presentation that receives further support from the Gandhari, Sanskrit, Tocharian, and Uyghur fragments. So there seems to be overwhelming textual support for the idea that the Pali is misled here, and it's actually the Buddha who's mentioning the benefits to Mahaprajapati,
that
not.
Also quite makes sense, but Ananda argues for 2 arguments.
Right.
The Buddha says, there's some difference in that, but you've also done this and this and this and that.
That's right.
It doesn't quite make sense. That's a bit.
It sounds more like he's dithering rather than he's making a case.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the Dakina Vibhanga Sutta and its main Chinese and Tibetan parallels continue by describing the debt of gratitude one owes to the person who establishes one in taking refuge, observing precepts, acquiring unwavering confidence, and in going beyond doubt in regard to the 4 noble truths. A noteworthy aspect in the individual translation, so that's just coming back here, so that's this one here, is that it refers to Mahaprajapati Gautami throughout as a nun. Okay, so she's called Mahaprajapati Bhikkhuni. The individual translation here.
So she's made a role most of it to the Buddha. As a nun, isn't that an offense in itself?
Well, that's in the thing. The monk doesn't give something back, but this could even predate that.
He's given stream entry back. Yeah, but. I mean, it's an interesting point, but it's just, I think it's just, yeah, I mean, it could be before that rule was established, or it could be a number of situations, but I think it's a valid point, though.
What about an offence for a monk to receive the robe?
Yeah, that's right, it's not an offence. He could have used the vineyard as an excuse to get out of it. Yeah, sorry, look, I can't, because it's Nisargiya Pacitti. Yeah. Okay, let's go on to see Analeo's discussion here. At first sight, this might seem surprising, since according to the Dakina Vibhanga Sutta and its parallels, one of the benefits that she had acquired thanks to the Buddha was her observance of the five precepts, which suggests her to be still a lay woman. Moreover, if at the time of the present event she had already been a nun, one would expect to find her going forth to be mentioned among the benefits she had derived from the Buddha, all the more so as according to a range of accounts, it was on her request that the nun's order had been instituted in the first place. Yet, if Mahaprajapati Gotami was indeed the first woman to receive the going forth as a Buddhist nun, then at the time of the present discourse she should already be a nun. As all three versions explicitly mention the community of nuns in their examination of the merits that accrue from different recipients of gifts, that is, later on, the part we haven't read yet, it talks about bhikkhunis, a reference to the existence of the order of nuns would not fit an event in which Mahaprajapati takes part as a lay woman. Indeed, and thus reinforcing theory that these are two quite separate textual fragments.
Actually, unless you see it as a hint by the Buddha that all the other Buddhas have had nuns, it's seen as an encouragement for her to go forward with the request. Her and Ananda right there hearing the Buddha say, all these other Buddhas have had nuns, then that's how I've always taken it.
Yeah, could be. Yeah, I mean, that's again. The text is as it is. I mean, I think, in terms of the text, you can say, well, there's an issue there in the sense that she seems to be a laywoman, and yet bhikkhunis are mentioned in the text. So yeah, that would be one reading of it.
Referring to Lord Buddha Gotama's bhikkhunis, but bhikkhu Buddhas of the past having had bhikkhunis.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
So that, I don't see why this has to be a conflict.
You know, you said that in some versions of the Mahaprajapati story, that third reason of Buddhas of the past have always had become.
Yeah.
In those versions, did that become the clincher? Or was that the last reason that sealed the deal?
I can't remember. It's complex. Each version has its own idiosyncrasies, and there's a lot of versions.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't remember which ones. There's which one.
A real recall. There was a lot of the stuff.
Yeah.
It's a bit later.
Yeah, yeah. Sure, yeah. Okay, so perhaps, Analia goes on, perhaps the reference to her observance of the five precepts could be understood to be simply a part of the pericope used to describe her taking of refuge, both together referring to the moment when she had become a lay follower. On adopting, in other words, when it says that she has the five precepts, it doesn't necessarily mean she's a lay person keeping five precepts, but that could be just a stock phrase which they're using. On adopting this viewpoint, having taken the five precepts need not necessarily imply that she's still a lay woman at the time of the present discourse, but would only refer to the point of time in the past when she had become a lay follower. If the main point of this description of benefits was to highlight that she'd become a Buddhist and a stream enterer, then the absence of any explicit reference to her going forth may become less puzzling. Another point which needs to be taken into consideration is that the different vineyards record a stipulation according to which it was allowable for a monk to receive a gift of robes from a nun if they were relatives. Ah, there you go, there's the vineyard thing. Yeah. Hence, independent of whether the present event took place before or after this regulation, for Gotami to give a robe to the Buddha would in principle have been possible even if she had already gone forth. Another argument in favour of her lay status would be that according to the Pali version, she had personally spun and woven the robe, an activity not befitting a nun. Yet according to the Chinese parallels, she had only made the robe, which could just intend the sewing, which is fine for monastics. Hence, independent of whether the present event took place before or after this regulation for Gautami to give a robe to the Buddha would in principle have been possible if you got four. Oh, we just did that one. So Analio sort of ends up being a bit ambivalent about that. Personally, I think that's a red herring. I think there's no way that she was a bhikkhuni at that point. And the fact that one Chinese version mentions the word Mahapajapati bhikkhuni to me seems obviously the easiest, the simplest explanation is that they normally use the stock phrase Mahapajapati bhikkhuni, and just became incorporated in the text as a sort of reflex action that you always write Mahapajapati bhikkhuni, and they kind of forgot that she wasn't a bhikkhuni at that point. So that to me is a very simple explanation, and you don't have to go through all of those gymnastics to try to justify the what is patently an implausible, if perhaps possible, but it seems to me a highly implausible suggestion that she wasn't wasn't ordained at that time. I'm sorry, that she was already ordained at that time. Okay, so with regards to that passage as a whole, then just to cap up, to repeat, is that there are several versions which have this introduction portion separate from the following version, and several details of both the difference and substance in several variations of both of substance and form between all the different versions, which does clearly show that there are textual problems here, and that there have been a number of scholarly attempts to try to resolve these problems. And as just to repeat, my own conclusion is that the most reasonable explanation is that these two parts, in fact, are completely different textual entities which became glued together. But anyway, let's go on to look at the discussion of the actual analysis of offering itself. So remember that the Buddha has just finished saying to Ananda that it's not easy to be repay someone who's given you spiritual benefits, not easy to repay them by giving respect and material gifts. And then the Buddha goes on to analyze 14 kinds of offering to an individual. Perhaps one might feel that this analysis goes on has a slightly different emphasis, because it is specifically talking about the merits of physical gifts, whereas in the previous passage the Buddha was tending to discount the value of material gifts. And then he goes on in detail to talk about that very thing, which he's just been at pains to say actually isn't so important after all. Well, perhaps that's not a major issue. Anyway, the 14 offerings to an individual. What 14? One gives to a realized one, a worthy one, a perfect enlightened Buddha. That's the first offering to an individual. One gives to an independent Sambuddha, Vacheka Buddha. One gives to an arahant disciple of a Buddha. One gives, that's the third individual offering, so Patipuggalika, offering to an individual. One gives to somebody who has entered upon the way to experiencing the fruit of arahantship. Arahata pala sacci kiriyaya patipanne danang deti. Now this is just one of the many passages which shows that the arahant, the one who's on the path to arahantship, is in fact a person. This might seem like a ridiculous thing to say, but according to the Pali Abhidhamma tradition, the Theravadan Abhidhamma tradition, this is not a person but a mind moment. And you're going to have to be pretty damn slick to offer a set of robes to a mind moment, all right?
Actually, you could just wait a moment and then offer it to an
arahant. Yeah, exactly. Exactly, you'd get even more merit by doing that. Yeah.
Much income. Yeah.
Yeah. And this, of course, is very standard in the suttas. There's a dozen or more references to this person who's a one practicing on the way to arahantship, who is obviously a person, not a mind moment. Or I might go further into that theory. You can ask me about it later on if you're interested. But, okay, further on, the fourth offering to an individual, then the fifth offering is to an anagami, the sixth is to one practicing who's entered upon the way to experiencing the fruit of anagami ship, then to a once returner, and then one practicing for once return, and then to a stream enterer, and then one who's practicing on the way to stream entry. So these are the normal eight kinds of noble beings, those who are at the four stages of enlightenment, and those who've entered upon the path to each of those four stages of enlightenment. Then it goes on to talk about another group, other people. And one gives to an outsider, bahirake kamesu vitarage danangdeti. So an outsider who's free of lust for sensual pleasures. What that means is a non-Buddhist ascetic, someone who's not enlightened, but the mention of kamesu vitaraga implies that they are successful in their jhana practice. You give to, that's the 11th offering, and one gives to a ordinary virtuous person, puthujana silavante. Okay? That's the 12th offering to an individual. You give to an unvirtuous ordinary person. That's the 13th offering. You give to an animal. That's the 14th offering. And then he goes back into reverse. So he's first of all, he's just listed the 14 different individuals, and now he goes on to give like the interest rates that you get from in various investments in those accounts. Yes, it does not mention making offerings to hungry ghosts. That's a very good point. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. Here, and under having given gift to an animal, you get 100-fold in return. So that's pretty good. Yeah? Sorry? Yeah, yeah. Right, yeah.
2,000 years.
I didn't think of that, yeah. That's true, yeah. Yeah. Deceptive advertising, okay. Okay, so 100-fold return. It should list the time period as well. I think that's right. It should have per annum here. We should, okay. Then having given to an unvirtuous, and then if you get, so you get 100-fold from an animal, then if you give to a, sorry? Well, just the karmic percentages.
If you give a cookie, 100 cookies back?
Something like that, yeah. If you give to an unvirtuous ordinary person...
But if you give a donkey biscuit, uh-huh. You get 100 donkey biscuits.
If you give, moving right along, if you... if you give...
Well, why does it matter?
That's... Oh, I know. Yeah, yeah, it's very influential.
But I mean, do you doubt this concept? Do you think it's not credible that the Buddha would say that?
Yeah.
That there's a lesser return based on the purity of the recipient.
Can we discuss it in just a minute? Because we'll go through the thing, because not everybody here is as familiar with the text as we are. So we might just go through the thing first, and then we'll talk about that later on. Okay, so having given to an unvirtuous ordinary person, you get 1,000-fold. Okay, so if you give to, let's say, a wife-beating bastard, then you get 1,000-fold. Then if you give to a virtuous ordinary person, then you get 100,000-fold to be expected. If you give to a jhana practitioner, non-Buddhist practitioner of jhanas, then you get 100,000 times 100,000-fold. Koti sahasa hasa hasa guna. Having given a gift to once entered upon the way to experiencing the fruit of stream entry, and immeasurable, unlimited offering is to be expected. Yeah? Asankeya apameya. What to say about a stream entry? What to say about one who's on the path to once return? What to say about a once returner? What to say about one on the path to non-return? What to say about a non-returner? What to say on the path of arahantship? And what to say about an arahant? What about a Pacheka Buddha and a Tathagata? So, in other words, once you hit so stream one on the path to stream entry, you basically just you just Yeah, it's just a perpetual jackpot. So then to come back to Sadama's. Now there's a couple of interesting mathematical questions here, and the mathematical implication is here: does this imply the recognition of a hierarchy of infinities? Right? Okay. Do we have a hierarchy of infinities here? You can have an infinity to give to a stream enterer, but then an even bigger infinity if you give to a once returner. And then an even bigger infinity. Yeah?
Perception.
It implies that.
Yeah, I mean, it is a thing in mathematics, I believe. You can have different orders of infinities. Like the set of whole numbers is infinite, but the set of even numbers is also infinite, but it's obviously half as big as the set of whole numbers. And at that point, your brain blows up.
You can have like one-dimensional, infinite, and then three-dimensional, and then five-dimensional.
Exactly, yeah.
Whatever way.
Yeah.
You get like an infinity of good stuff in 100 years,
uh-huh.
An infinity of good stuff in 50 years,
right, yep.
An infinity of good
stuff
next year.
Yep. But can you get an infinity of stuff in a finite time? I'm doubtful about that.
Everything is
here.
Use your imagination.
Okay, so then the question, the more serious question, is this what the Buddha said? I mean, it certainly strikes me as being highly kind of materialistic, sort of spiritual materialistic in its approach. I mean, of course, it's a basic principle of Buddha that you have karma and cause and effect, and we've discussed this in previous sutta classes. But the idea that you can sort of do a mathematics of that, and a mathematics which, shall we say, somewhat suspiciously seems to favour the person who's doing the mathematical analysis, right? Then it is something which personally is not one of the passages that say for myself personally, it doesn't inspire me as being overwhelmingly sounding like what I would expect from a fully enlightened Buddha. But who am I? Anyway,
the way I sort of see it is that once you get to the people who are on the Eightfold Path, and give them a gift to be in, there's a much more awesome opportunity. Then somebody isn't on the Eightfold Path, and potential benefits really are immeasurable. You can't measure the freedom from samsara.
Samsara
is immeasurable.
In that case, yeah, I agree with that, and I think that's why it is there's an immeasurable aspect to it there, and I think that the general principle that if you give to virtuous people that it's more worthwhile. I think that's basically common sense. I mean, if you give to, this is one of the big problems with charities in the world, is that so much of money is given to charity, is given to people who aren't virtuous, and they waste it. You know, it gets given onto, instead of going to food, it goes to guns, and it gets siphoned off into corruption and all of this kind of thing. And so I think it's clearly much more worthwhile to give money to people who are going to be good people and are going to make that work. So I don't have a problem with that principle, but it doesn't. Anyway, so
If you keep that, well, could it be they will occur another. All meditation chanter in Burma accept a lot of abundance of offering, but the flesh and no meditation people eat it, just offer to the ordinary, even ordinary monk who do not do meditation, have magic. That is why they don't offer a lot to the ordinary people.
It's a negative effect, and then that, of course, then leads to the corruption of all the meditation monasteries, right? Because then they get rich.
In Thailand, for example, the Sangha become very rich.
Very rich, yeah.
Because people believe that they have punya ketan.
Yep.
Punya ketan gets the fuel of magic, and they give and finally caught up.
Yeah. That's very true, yeah.
I think that all of this, these mathematics, makes sense in the context of the rest of the sutta.
Uh-huh.
Because he ends up making the point that even as extraordinary as the merit is of a gift to the one on the very highest of that pyramid,
uh-huh.
Even though that inverted pyramid he just gave it.
Yeah.
That a gift to Sangha for the sake of Sangha is more powerful even than that. So,
which is what he's going to go on to, yeah? Yeah, we haven't finished
it
yet.
I take it so much as an intention to get across the idea that this one is exactly this much higher than that one, but to kind of blow your mind with how much more powerful it is to give to, the higher ups on the list, and then to say, well, you're covering those when you give to the Sangha.
Mm.
So the point being a very intense, powerful teaching about the extraordinary benefit, the extraordinary impact of giving the Sangha. Now, whether our Lord would extend that, or whether those were words of someone else who had other motives, that's another question, but it does make sense to me in the context.
Yeah, no, that's very true, and it's also, I think, important to make the point that numbers don't mean the same thing for us than they did as they did for ancient peoples generally, and for ancient Indians in particular. We think of numbers purely as being a sort of an abstract accounting mathematical thing. Whereas in ancient times, numbers always are felt to be something that's very deeply meaningful, and that in some way they capture something about the nature of the universe. All of these, the kind of the sciences like numerology and so on and so forth, these are all inspired by the numinous and the powerful effect that the understanding of numbers has when you first start to understand, you first start to make sense of the universe. Especially through arts like astrology, music, and so on. When you discover these mathematical ratios in art and architecture as well, you discover these mathematical ratios and points of perfection between one part of the universe and the other. And this has a very powerful effect that numbers have a numinous and almost a magical quality to them. So it's in that sense, it's not to be understood as accounting in the sense that we might understand it today, but it's more in a sense of like I was saying, like kind of blowing your mind by just going out and out and out to bigger and bigger numbers until you lose, you just can't conceive of anymore. It's taking you out to something inconceivable, and that's the actual purpose of it.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, even without getting into the idea of numbers being profound, but just as a simple teaching tool, like for someone who's not good at math, when you have very simple math, like
mm-hmm.
getting increased in bigger numbers very clearly,
mm-hmm.
sort of gets the message across to your students. Like, yeah, much better.
Yeah.
Much better.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe it's just, it's not, I think it has developed in what Ayodhya was saying, where it becomes this kind of strategizing in this spiritual materialistic way where you're like in Thailand, it's like, which temple has the arhats? We're going there to give money because, like, it's so much better return. You know, it becomes like that kind of. But I don't think the original intention was that, or that it has to be interpreted in that way. And also, to speak to like that thing about what you're saying, then the places get corrupt when they get really rich because of this kind of thinking. But I remember, like, something in a talk by Ajahn Brahm about how he was saying, but there's like a kind of safety valve built in where it's like if people are really realized, then even though they get really, tons of donations, it's not going to corrupt them. So by encouraging giving to, like, pure people, it's not so dangerous because those people can be trusted to give it away or not to be corrupted by their wealth.
Yeah, unfortunately, if you look in practice, it doesn't work unless you're a kickboxer. I mean, the only monk that I know where that's actually worked is Ajahn Mahabua, who actually gave away everything and actually kept his monastery really simple. Everybody else, the monasteries get built up and they develop. Yeah, fine, it might be fine for them, but it's not fine for everybody else in the community. That's the problem. It's not necessarily the one who's actually being offered the stuff. It's everybody else.
Yeah.
I mean, it has a very powerful corrupting influence. Yeah.
In those days, were monasteries repositories of financial wealth?
Did
monasteries receive coins? Did monasteries receive money? Or did they just receive timber and...
As for the Buddha's day, there's no real mention of monasteries keeping coins, but it's also true to say that most of our knowledge of ancient Indian coins comes from coins recovered from Buddhist monasteries.
Mm.
So just sort of repeat that. It's not merely the fact that there's occasionally coins found in Buddhist monasteries. Most of the Indian coins that we have from ancient India come from Buddhist monasteries. Between 1 to 2,000 years. There's no monasteries earlier than that anyway. I saw that story as well. Yeah, there was a huge treasure that was found. It was just quite a humble little temple in some village or something. And then suddenly they got, I think, like $1 billion or something ridiculous of... Yeah. Yeah, yeah, no, it was a huge find. And the I bet as a result of that, there's a lot of people in India going around to a lot of other sites of a lot of other old temples, digging them up. In some of the Buddhist temples, they not only find coins, they even find coin presses. They made the things in the monasteries. So Gregory Chopin is the expert on all of the financial corruption in major Buddhist monasteries. So, if you're interested, Buddhist Monks and Business Matters is the relevant text. Go on.
It just, in my experience, it actually seems right.
What?
Well, I put aside the accounting of cookies and dog biscuits.
Uh-huh.
Talking something like giving respect, you know, giving ear. It's sort of a given of yourself, sort of.
Uh-huh.
In my experience, you do get absolutely phenomenally huge rewards from that. And it does seem to be a bit of a scale. If you give that to a person who's like a common thief,
uh-huh.
Yes, it's nice. But, you know, it's a lot sort of... It's kind of you give, don't get much back.
That's right, yeah.
And then if you give something that's really wonderful, then you get a lot back in terms of happiness and that. And
you can give someone,
like, okay, jump on. And just like,
boom. Yeah, yeah.
That was my experience anyway.
Yeah, sure. No.
You can think of at least one other sutta in which the Buddha is saying something like this about the power of giving based on the recipient. Do you recall many others?
There's not many. There are one or two like that. I think Analio refers to one. I think it's, you know, not a kind of very common theme, but I think there are a couple of places that say something similar. Yeah.
Why wouldn't the true power of giving just be equal? The true power of giving, if it's with the right intention and from the right heart, should be equal.
We haven't finished the analysis yet, so maybe that question might be answered a little bit later on. Okay, let's continue. We've got some more bits in there, and as Ayasadama mentioned earlier, some of the things that come later put that all in perspective. We've only had part of the analysis so far. But having the 14 kinds of offering to an individual, we now have the 7 kinds of offering to a community or a sangha. What's the 7 kinds of offering to the sangha? You give to both sanghas with the Buddha at the head, Buddha Pamukhe Ubato Sangha Danang Deti. So Ubato Sangha, of course, being bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. After the Buddha's passed away, you give a dana to both sanghas. That's the second kind of offering. To give a offering.
How do you give an offering to the Ubato Sangha? Does it have to be a situation where they're both sitting there, or if you just go to the bhikkhus monk? Oh, yeah, it has to be right where they're both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis are present.
I don't think they would necessarily have to be present, as long as it's clear that it's dedicated for both sanghas.
Like if a monk's monastery is just for monks, then if you go and you give the Buddha Dhyana, it's not like, hey, you have any extras? Give some to Dhammasara.
Well, that would be right. Yeah, if it's not meaningful, yeah, I would say it would have to be meaningful.
Yeah.
Well, that's right, and that's why when I went to Indonesia a couple of years ago, and I told them all that if they wanted to have the Bhikkhuni Sangha, the best way of having the Bhikkhuni Sangha was to go along to their local monastery and say that they want to offer katina for that year. And then when the monks say sadhu, 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 you say, well, and just want to check before I confirm, do you have bhikkhunis living here? And when they say no, then you say, oh, look, I'm sorry, we'll have to offer katina at Santi Monastery instead because we need the merit. and if you do that a few times to the bhikkhus, then they'll change their minds on the existence of bhikkhunis very quickly. I don't know if anybody took me out.
So whenever the devotee makes the offering, we ask them to be chanted as the offering to both bhikkhus. The uposa,
Ubato Sangha.
Ubato Sangha.
Yeah.
One of the guys he takes a for the devotee to come to offer.
Good. Yeah.
And because you would die normal, so they used to take it with the rally. In order to remind them. Is it
Bao Shangha?
Look at
that,
the hash.
Ah, okay. Yeah,
beautiful.
Okay, so then the third offering is to the Bhikkhu Sangha. The fourth offering is to the Bhikkhuni Sangha. The next offer is to, one gives after saying, a gift to so and so. This many monks and nuns have been nominated from the monks and nuns community, so it's a group of the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. So you might say, well, I'm going to give to the monks and nuns at Santi Forest Monastery, for example, rather than just to the bhikkhu and bhikkhuni sangha as a whole. I should clarify this for is when it's referring to the sangha in this sense, the gift is given to the universal sangha, not to the community in a particular monastery. Whereas this fourth offering is to say, well, I'm going to give to maybe to everyone in this monastery, or to perhaps one group or this group of people at this monastery. For example, maybe a few who you've invited for dana, and then you make the offering to those that group who's been invited for dana or something like that.
But then in Thailand, let's say, like if someone went to their local monastery and there's only monks there, but in their heart they wanted to support the Ubato Sangha, could they,
Feel
like they were giving to that, even though practically speaking, it never really would filter it out?
I don't know.
So this speaks to Rumi's point about like how it's really about how your heart is, or that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think there would have to be a real. Personally, I think there would have to be a realistic, realistic expectation that would be shared with the Bhikkhuni Sangha.
Yeah, that would be domestic. Why not?
Yeah.
But couldn't you then, you could give it and then say this is for the Bhikkhu and Bhikkhuni Sangha?
You can say that, yeah.
And then when the Bhikkhus don't want to share it, Bhikkhus and Bhikkhus can come to the where people offer it for the Bhikkhu and Bhikkhuni Sangha, so...
Well, definitely, yeah.
It.
Yeah.
And so if you make that clear, if you only give to the monks, you say it's for Bhikkhus and Bhikkhuni, so in case there would have a Bhikkhuni would walk in, she could take it too. You know, even if only
that's why there should be Bhikkhuni, so people can get there.
Okay, so moving along. Then, so that's the C, and then to give to so-and-so group of monks or so-and-so group of nuns, that's the seventh offering to the community. Now, and then the Buddha goes on, another interesting little part. There will, in the future of time, be clansmen with an ochre robe around their necks who are unvirtuous and bad-natured. These are Gotra Bhuno. Kasa va kanta dusila papadamha. So gotra is family. Bhuna. Either could mean clansmen, family belonging to the family, or destroyers of the clan. Okay? Yeah. Now, this is an interesting term. It's about the only term that this actually occurs in the suttas, gotrabhu, but became, curiously enough, a technical term in the Theravadin, in the Visuddhimagga, in the sequence of enlightenment, in the Vipassanjnanas. One of the highest stages of the Vipassanjnanas is the gotrabhu jnana, and in that context, the bhu means destroyer. And so it's the destroyer of the lineage. So in other words, somebody, the Gotrabhu, is the one who is letting go of the lineage of the Patujana and is about to turn to the lineage of the noble ones. And that's the Gotrabhu.
Gotra, your lineage.
Sorry?
Your lineage.
Gotra, yeah.
So the one who destroys your lineage.
Something like that, yeah.
So the translation here is not the lineage.
I think it's linguistically, I think it's ambiguous. I think it can be translated both ways. But yeah, obviously, and it could make sense in both translations. Personally, I think it's more likely to mean a destroyer of the lineage, because it is a very unusual saying. I mean, if it just meant clansmen, surely they'd just use Kulaputta.
Destroyer of lineage, it means one who not trauma.
Yeah.
I think more meaningful than more correct
through
the
Pali. I would agree, yeah. Yeah. So basically, all they've got left, they've got bad behaviour, everything's wrong. The only thing they've got is a little scrap of yellow cloth around their necks, and that's the only thing they've got left of the monastic life. Even given to a sangha of them, okay, even giving to them, dedicating it to the sangha, okay, so sanghang uddisa, so this is utit in Thai, so sanghang uddisa, at that time there's still... the offering is immeasurable and uncalculable. Okay, so even if all there's left is some bad monks with some scrap of yellow cloth around their neck, it's still better to give to a community. And then the Buddha goes on to say, and certainly in no way, Ananda, do I say that a gift given to an individual can have a greater fruit than an offering to a community. Okay, so what he's saying is even that worst sangha offering with the gotrabhus and the scrap of yellow cloth is still better, more merit than offering to the Buddha.
But that's because the gift is directed still to the sangha.
It's still directed to the sangha. Yeah. That's right, yeah. It's still dedicated to the sangha. Yeah. Well, that's his problem.
But it doesn't affect the... Because usually a karma uh-huh. has to follow through from, you know, from giving to the receiving end. That's my understanding. So if you give it to someone who actually doesn't give to the sangha,
mm-hmm.
so then the whole action from intention doesn't follow through to the benefit.
That's actually what the next section is going to be talking about.
No,
yeah?
Wait a minute. Let's say a monk is the only monk living within 100 miles and people give to that monk with the thought of giving it to Sangha. Are you saying that monk has to somehow manage to distribute that out to Sangha all over the place?
No, I mean at least when, if he has a monastery...
Yeah.
And if the monastery is supposed to be for the sangha in the 10 directions,
yeah.
for you know, past and future and everything, and if he actually live like a lay person and keep everything in his own cap for himself, have no intention for sharing with the rest of the sangha,
yeah.
and you give it to such a person,
yeah.
and this sutta suggests that well if you give it. The intention of giving to sangha, even with such a person, is still immeasurable.
Yeah, even worse than that. I mean, even if he has wife and kids and
yeah.
doing all the wrong
but
things.
Then,
yes.
But then, you know, but then if it's such a case that this person actually keep it everything to himself and doesn't have the intention to share at all with the rest of the sangha,
it's nothing to do with
then sangha
them.
Wouldn't be benefiting.
So, nothing to do with him.
So, yeah, so my question was, When action doesn't follow through from intention to the actual fruit of that action, usually my understanding is I just wasn't sure.
That's what the next part's going to be talking about. Yes, Rainy. Sorry, Aya? Rainy was talking?
Was it clear about why it's better to give to the whole Sangha rather than the Buddha? Is that because of the numbers?
Yes, it's a kind of multiplication game again. No, the text doesn't say why, and so we're left to our own devices to infer why. One could say that when you give to the Sangha, you know, that it's given to all of the those who are practicing who are purified. But I think there's also something, if you look at the tendency, the Buddha always emphasized about the importance of those making an effort as well. So by giving to the Sangha, you're not just giving to those who are already at a spiritual practice, but you're giving to that which is going to support the future attainment of Nibbana as well. And also, I think from the subjective side, from the person who's giving, then there, of course, there's less personal attachment in giving to an organization rather than giving to a person. So you notice how that depersonalization of things, right? And so this is, the whole thing is depersonalizing, right? The Buddha's trying to get away from a Mahapajapati kind of attachment and everything. And notice how it's exactly the opposite of the strategy that charities use to get people to give more, right? Interesting, isn't it? Yeah? What they'll do is they'll specifically will personalize it, because they know if they can get you to sponsor giving money to one child in Africa, yeah, then you'll give whatever it is, $100 a month or something, to help that child in Africa. Even though perhaps if you gave $100 a month to help children in Africa, you might be able to use that money more effectively to, you know, purify a water supply or something and actually help a lot more children. But by making that emotional connection, that in fact encourages people to offer more. So, you know, I think that is very much a tendency. And so the Buddha's, you know, I think that there is something to that idea that we tend to make gestures from an emotional basis rather than from a more objective consideration of what's going to create the greatest benefit.
Also, giving to the Sangha, another reason why it's more merit is because you're not just that you're supporting people who are practicing, but that you're supporting a vehicle that will continue passing on the teachings after the Buddha has died. If you give to the Buddha, well, he's gone in a few years. If you give to the sorry,
he can just keep wearing his old robes. It doesn't matter. He's going to be dead soon anyway. Sure. No, I understand, and I think that's also true. Yeah, you're giving for more of a long-term institutional support. Yeah, definitely. Although the problem with that is that again, all these things do become corrupted, and that you end up just giving to support the community rather than anything else. To support the institution, maintaining the upkeep of monasteries and this kind of thing, rather than actually doing what it's supposed to be doing. Anyway, moving on to the next section, which I've been referring to hopefully for the last 10 or 20 minutes. Chatasso panimang ananda dakina visuddhyo. There are, and under these four purifications of offerings, what for? There is an offering which is purified by the giver, not by the receiver. Okay, so in case where you have the giver is giving from a pure heart, but the receiver is like really grasping and stuff like that, yeah? And then there's an offering which is given by purified by the receiver and not by the giver. So the giver might give because I'm going to give some money because it'll make me look good and people will think I'm a really good person if I'm seen to be giving dana. But if the recipient is pure, then that's pure on that side. There's a gift which is purified neither by the giver nor by the receiver. Yeah? That would be the case, let's say, the case where a corrupt politician is giving to a corrupt contractor to do a work which is actually not going to do anybody any good except for making the politician get re-elected and giving more profits to the contractor.
I'll give it that neutral carbon, but in that sense, probably not.
Mm. Then there is an offering that is purified by the giver and the receiver. That's what it says in the next bit. And what is an offering that's purified by the giver and not by the receiver? Here the giver is virtuous and good-natured, and the receivers are unvirtuous and bad-natured. Papa dhamma. So that's what basically means if it's purified, if the person is has good sila. And how is it purified by the receiver, not by the giver? The giver is unvirtuous, but the receiver is virtuous. It's purified by neither if neither of them are virtuous, and it's purified by both if both of them are virtuous. These are the four purifications of offerings. In terms of what it actually means, of what it's purified, I think that's just a sort of general term, but I think it probably the implication seems to be that it's more effective.
So, how is this answer my previous question exactly?
Your question was about whether it's just the donor or the recipient. So here it's saying that it's both the donor and the recipient play a part. But it doesn't say that the gift is worthless just because the recipient is unvirtuous. But it's just a factor that it's just less pure. That's all. Yeah. So I think in that case, elsewhere. I mean, the other factor which is to be taken into account is the actual gift itself, whether the gift is appropriate. Right, so you might have a pure, good-hearted parent who gives a gift to their pure, good-hearted child, but they give a fully loaded M16 to their child, and then that would be unpurified because of that, even if they have the best of intentions. They're just going to find. Yeah, so. So there's those three kind of factors. So if any of those factors are inadequate, then the kind of the merit of the gift is lessened, that it's not necessarily destroyed. Yeah, you think about it like you can also use a farming analogy. The giver is like the farmer, the gift is the seed, and the recipient is the soil. So if the farmer is stupid and sows it at the wrong time and throws it in the wrong place and all of that kind of thing, then it'll be less effective. But still, something might grow. Yeah, the seed might be not very good. Yeah, but if it's still got something to it, then it'll still grow. And the ground might be kind of rocky and not very fertile, but still something might grow in there. But if you've got all three, if you've got a stupid farmer, bad seed, and rocky ground, then I don't like your chances. You might get something. There's still hope.
Does this sutra kind of prove that there's more merits to give to monks than to nuns?
Yeah, well, it doesn't actually say that as such, but it does list the bhikkhus before the bhikkhunis, which is, of course, conventional. It doesn't actually say that it's more, but you could interpret it that way. Kind of, yeah. Remember that you've got the stream enterer and then the hierarchies of infinities on top of that, and then these are all bigger than those hierarchies of infinities, right? Yeah, so you're talking about big infinities. Yeah. So that's true enough. I think it's a fairly true to say that that's the implication. Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's just, to be honest, I think it's just convention that Bhikkhu Sangha is mentioned first and Bhikkhuni Sangha.
Most of the problem is that it's giving to both is the best.
Exactly.
Giving them equally, that's the best.
I think so, I think that's very true, yeah.
I think it's wonderful that the Buddha did not give a possibility of a living Buddha if he had it only a Bhikkhu.
That's another very valid point, yeah. The living, yeah.
In theory, if Mama Dhamma Gotami was only a woman and if there was a Bhikkhuni Sangha right then that's what they had, and he doesn't even mention it as a possibility.
Yeah, absolutely. There's only the Buddha with the twofold Sangha. There's never a Buddha with just the onefold Sangha. Well, yes, this is the point. And then the nuns actually exist at the time, yeah. So, yes, so then the Buddha, having said that, the Buddha goes on to say the following verses. That virtuous person who, with a mind full of confidence, gives a gift that's been righteously obtained to unvirtuous people. So here he's talking about the purification of the gift itself, which is not actually being mentioned earlier. So the gift has been righteously obtained. In other words, you're not nicking something and giving it or whatever, getting something from the corruption, but that's part of the purification of the gift. Whose great faith in actions and their result, yeah? So you have faith in karma and its result, that gift will be purified by the giver. Who unvirtuous person who, with a mind lacking in confidence, gives a gift that's been unrighteously obtained to virtuous people. Appasannacitto. It doesn't say confident in what. Often pasanna means faith in Buddhism, but it might mean, in this case, faith in the next line it says who talks about faith in the karma and its fruit of karma. Because it's poetry. Why would they repeat it? Asking that question of the Pali Canon. But there's a repetition. Who does not have great faith in actions and their results, that gift will be purified by the receiver. That unvirtuous person who, with a mind lacking in confidence, gives a gift that's been unrighteously obtained to unvirtuous people, who does not have a great faith in actions and their results, that gift will not bring an extensive reward, I say. Okay, so the only one he says you don't get much reward is if everything's bad. Yeah, the giver is bad, the gift is bad, and the recipient's bad as well. That virtuous person who, with a mind full of confidence, gives a gift that's been righteously obtained to virtuous people, who has great faith in actions and their results, that gift will bring an extensive reward, I say. And then last one, that passionless person, vidarago, who's mindful of confidence, gives to another mind person who's also passionless, who has great faith in actions and their results, that gift is the highest of worldly gifts. Yeah? Well, there's actually kind of a couple of problems with that last little verse. I haven't really looked at this closely before. One problem is the word vidaraga. It actually is the same word vidaraga that was used before for the non-Buddhist ascetic. So that was this is normally interpreted here that it means arahant. So the word vidaraga normally means an arahant. But in some cases, it also just means somebody who's attained jhanas. So, in earlier, it clearly was talking about a non-Buddhist, but here is interpreted by the commentary as being an arahant giving a gift to another arahant. But it's interesting that's a different usage. But the other interesting issue here is it says, well, that's the best worldly gifts, but we've just been told that the gift to a Sangha is better than any kind of gift to an individual.
So maybe not we're talking about Sangha, will we?
Yeah, I have one question.
So, yes.
If he is karma and they make normal karma, right. And then Arahant gives to Arahant. So
well, there's no karma. It doesn't say that you make merit. It just says it's the best kind of gift. I think it's the best kind of gift because there isn't any karma. Yeah.
It just says
it's the highest, the agga of worldly giving. So giving, and that could be translated two ways actually. Ananda Jyoti has the highest of worldly gifts, right? Now the word amisa could be translated as material. So you could translate it as, that's the highest gift of material things. Okay, so in other words, it's leaving aside, say, the spiritual gifts which the Buddha was giving and so on. So that's one way of interpreting it. Or another way of interpreting it, perhaps, would be that it's the highest kind of giving that's still within the material sphere. So in that case, we'd actually agree with that the vitaraga thing that was earlier, because the vitaraga was the last one where they could actually put a number on it. Yeah? So it's the last one they could calculate, and after that it went to the immeasurable. So perhaps what it's saying here, rather than saying is when one arahant gives to another arahant, it's talking about when one jhana practitioner, or one, you know, very, very advanced yogi gives to another very advanced yogi, then that's still within the calculable sphere of things, right? But that's the best of all the calculable sphere of things. Beyond that, you're into the...
Yeah, isn't there still
kind of a down note.
Does that mean they to be trying to outdip each other?
I don't know.
Is that right?
Yeah, you're quite right. It is a bit of a downer at the end, but it is interesting that it has that same word. I hadn't noticed that before, that it uses the same word, vitaraga, in that sense.
Could this be three different...
Could be, yeah. I mean, if we're taking the bungability hypothesis, then the fact that it ends up on a downer shouldn't necessarily be a problem. That might be just another indication might be another indication that we've got a bit of clumsy cut and pasting going on.
What other references in the Bali does it use with passionless people that you can think of?
Usually that word vitaraga is a word referring to an enlightened person.
Yeah, it refers to being
passionless.
Yeah. Maybe when you're right, enlightened.
It's not all white either.
Uh-huh.
Like in your contemplation in the Kirtan and Patrana,
uh-huh.
You mentioned from some moment you might meet a rag or meet a dosha.
That's true, yeah.
So it's just occasionally, it's not all the time with a rag.
That's a very good point, yes. In the Satipatthana Sutra, it talks about contemplation of mind as from time to time will be saragang vachittang and vitaragang vachittang, yeah, with lust and without lust, and sa dosang vachittang, vita dosang, and so on. So yeah, maybe that means doesn't mean an arahant at all. Maybe it just means giving with a pure heart. Yeah, you're not attached to the giving. You're not attached to receiving the gift. Yeah, at that time. Yeah.
Also interesting. It still says there's great faith and heart and fruit.
Yeah.
And arahant. So. Bit much better sort of thing.
Maybe.
Mm. Both those endings make me happy.
Okay, well that's the main thing. Yeah. Idam avocha bhagava atmana matiyam binam bhintam.
It's worth it.
Is that my view, that view,
Yeah.
I feel like
I've
just been given a bunch of
flair. I was going to say, to go back to your lady's point, and also my question about the word confidence, maybe it's confidence in the recipient. Like, maybe that explains why, you know, if you give to more virtuous people, then you would get more return, not just in this mathematical sense, but like what Renal Nandia was saying, because they inspire this faith in you, so you would have a purer heart when you gave that gift.
Maybe, yeah.
I think when there is a given of a gift, there's always an inescapable psychological sort of reality to the whole process.
Uh-huh.
You know, there was a reason a gift was given to that person. There's something going on in the mind.
Right.
You know, some sort of inspiration or something. So you can't escape that and just reduce it to accounting.
Yeah.
Have you thought of a witness says about the other?
Yeah, we haven't. We have to keep going. Right. Oh, yeah, we've got quite a bit left there. Okay, let's go. Thank you for reminding. Yeah.
That felt like a police question.
Okay. Okay. So one difference between the various versions is that in the Pali we had the 14 individual recipients followed by the seven kinds of group offerings, and that's the same in the individual translation. This one here, and also in one of the fragments, which is not mentioned there. However, the order is, the sequence of the two is reversed. First of all, we have the group offering and then the individual offering in the Sarvastivadin version and also in the Abhidharma Kosha Namatika version. And of course, as you well know, that would be expected because they both come from similar school backgrounds, both being Sarvastivada and all the Sarvastivada. So That's, yeah, you got the 7 first and then the 14. So you're all going, I knew that. Moving on. The 14 recipients of personal offerings are presented in the parallel versions in similar ways. Although here too a difference in sequence manifests in as much as the individual translation and the Gandhari fragment begin with the lowest recipient, whereas the other versions start up with the highest recipient. So it's whether it's one way or the other. While in the Madhyama Agama and Tibetan versions, as well as the Gandhari fragment, agree with the Madhyama Nikaya discourse in ranking a gift to an animal as the lowest in their respectives listings. In the individual translation, as this one, the lowest recipient of gifts. Can anyone guess what's the lowest recipient of gifts according to the individual translation? It's not an animal. What is it? Hell beings. Insane. To a sick and suffering person. That's terrible.
Where is that?
Giving to a sick and suffering person is the worst.
What?
That's in this one here. That's in the evil T84, which I've now decided. Hopefully it's a translation mistake. It doesn't look like it. Yeah, it doesn't. Probably a hundredfold, I guess. It differs. That version also. Oh, hang on. It goes on to talk about the percentages. Okay. T84 also differs from the other versions in the numerical value. So the Pali, there's the Sarvasivadin version, the Abhidharma Kaushupaika Namatika version, the Bahaja Karoshti fragment, which is not here, all attribute a hundredfold result to the lowest gift to an animal, and then mention a thousandfold to an immoral person, and then 100,000, and then 100,000 times 100,000, which is 1,000,000. Or 100,000 times 100,000. No, that's not 1,000,000. That's a lot less than 1,000,000. 100,000 times 10 is 1,000,000. Okay. Or 1,000,000-fold. So some of them have 1,000,000. Result to giving to an outsider fee from last and immeasurable result up from there. Now, this one, the Satan's version, begins with a twofold result for giving to someone who's sick. Twofold! Twofold! That's about. Yeah, they didn't even bother putting it down. Now this is, sorry, that was very misleading of you to say that the lowest one should be a woman. This is talking about meritorious offerings. Yeah. So this is getting worse and worse. A twofold result for giving to someone who's sick, followed by a hundredfold to an immoral person, thousand to a virtuous person, 100,000. No, just an immoral. So the similarly measures immeasurable and so on. Okay, and then another context, King Pasenadi in the Ekottarika Agama, which is probably Mahasangika text, refers to a version of this exposition which he claims to have heard from the Buddha, according to which a hundredfold result is what you get from offering to an animal, 1,000 to an immoral person, 10,000 to a virtuous, and 100,000,000-fold result if it's given to a seer free from lust, and immeasurable for the rest. That's kind of similar to the others. So it's mainly just one version. Hmm. Right. So I thought that's just shocking, frankly. What is this individual translation anyway? I thought it was boring before, but now it might be interesting. According to the information given in the Taisho edition, the Satan's version was translated by Dhanapala. Dhanapala. While it has a discourse, it has a title discourse on an analysis spoken by the Buddha on giving, probably Dakina Vibhanga Sutta. Well, it gives you, so translated by Dhanapala, it doesn't give a date. I wonder if I can find out quickly that Dhanapala. No, no. I was trying to look at a Wikipedia article about Dhanapala. I don't know anything about Dhanapala.
Is it something about Japanese masters down there, Dhanapala translator?
Before, the previous one?
If you go back one.
Okay, I'll go with that and then just one sec. Versus Chinese translators, yeah, maybe. Doesn't look like.
Did you go back one?
Yeah.
There it is. No. Japanese mandala, Dhanapala's translation.
No, it doesn't look like it. Okay. Uh-huh. That's my opinion. Blah, 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 blah. Translators. So it says he's of Indian origin. Dhanapala was of Indian origin. So that's all we know. And this is a bit more information here. What's this from? Buddhism, Diplomacy and Trade, the Realignment of Sino-Indian Relations. Can't make it bigger. Where's the embiggerment? Here's the embiggerment. Can't make it all that much bigger, unfortunately. Google Books a bit limited. You can do. The Institute can. Oh, is it better? No, I'll do that. I should have one here. Font size is bigger. That's better. Okay. The Texi Institute continues to receive later versions of those previously translated into Chinese. 13 of 44 works attributed to Dhammadeva translations of such texts. Okay, 37 works attributed to Dhanapala were already available to the Chinese clergy. So this is talking about, he was a translator at an institute for the translation of the transmission of the Dhamma. Okay. So it looks like it's a sort of kind of stage of. Later stage of translation, perhaps, if it's the same Dhanapala. Anyway, okay, so we don't know much about him. Okay, moving along. Text. The Dakini Vibhanga Sutta and its parallels to take up the seven types of offering to the monastic community in similar terms. Okay. Now, here we find a difference between them, whereas the Pali version begins its listing with a gift given to both communities headed by the Buddha, Buddha Pamukhe Ubato Sanghe Danang Deti, the parallels only speak of the Bhikkhu community headed by the Buddha. Apparently, all of the parallels. He lists the Sarvasivadin, the individual Sessions version, the Abhidharma Koshapaka Namatika. So there's three versions, and they all mention only the Buddha, the Bhikkhus. Having said which, at least two of those versions are basically pretty much the same text. The Chinese and Tibetan texts are both Sarvasivadin, so that's no particular surprise. This one here and this one here are both from the Sarvasivadin group of schools, so there's no surprise that they're closely related.
Buddha
the head of the Bhikkhu Sangha, yeah. I haven't come to that bit. I presume so, yeah. And the same is also true for a reconstructed fragment of Gandhari, but there's a lot of reconstruction going on, but it does seem to say Bhikkhu Sangha, yeah. Another important difference is that the Sarvasivadin version does not list an offering given by requesting the appointment of some monks and some nuns. So that's missing. Okay. The Majjhima Nikaya version continues by describing the case of a gift that is received by evil and immoral monks. It explains that such a community will nevertheless be of incalculable merit as long as the gift is given to the Sangha as a whole. Now, Analia gives a couple of references to the Gotrabhu, the change of lineage, or the clansman or destroyer of the lineage. There are a couple of other references to Gotrabhu in the Pali Canon. I mentioned before that it was termed in the Theravadin Visuddhimagga, and I omitted to mention, I should have mentioned, that it's also found a couple of times in the Pali Canon as a term for somebody about to become a noble one. So that's also a Gotrabhu. So generally speaking, it has a positive connotation in the Pali Canon, and this negative connotation in this sutta is isolated. The expression Kasava Gantha, with a yellow cloth around the neck, it also recurs in a verse found in the Dhammapada, Itivutika, and Vinaya. Okay. Notably, the individual translation and the parts that have been preserved in Gandhari fragment do not take up this case at all, so they don't have the Gotrabhu. The Majjhima Agama discourse and the Tibetan versions have a comparable treatment, although it's still different from the Majjhima Nikaya version. Both do not speak of evil and immoral monks as a recipient of gifts given to the community, while the Tibetan version does not provide any explicit ethical qualifications of such monks. In the Majjhima Agama account, such monks are simply not energetic. Okay. There's the Uyghur fragment seems to be similar to the Pali, however, as it speaks of an undisciplined and lawless monk, as is the case for a quotation from the present discourse in the Chinese Udana collection at T212. So there's a couple of references that seem to be referring to an undisciplined one, even though we don't have enough context to be able to say with too much clarity. The Majjhima Agama version then continues by explaining that when even it's this version here, even when a gift to a monk who is not energetic, it was of great merit on account of being given to the community, what can be said of the merit given to a monk who practices and has reached various accomplishments? The Majjhima Nikaya version instead states that a gift to an individual will never be as meritorious as a gift given to the whole community. The commentary reports the reasoning that a gift given to the community will be purified on account of former arahants like Sariputta and Moggallana. The commentary further explains that even a gift given to an arahant individually will not measure up to a gift given to someone of bad morality, as long as the gift is given to the latter on behalf of the community as a whole. The question that a gift given on behalf of the Sangha, even if it's given to an immoral monk, will be of an incalculable merit seems difficult to reconcile, according to Venerable Analia, with the subsequent exposition of the four purifications of a gift in the Dakina Vibhanga Sutta and its parallels, which clearly indicates that the purification of a gift depends also on the degree of purity of the receiver. Fair enough. From this perspective, it seems doubtful if the existence of former arahant monks, as mentioned in the commentary, would suffice to turn a gift given on behalf of the community to a monk of evil character and bad morality into a gift that produces abundant merit. In fact, if dedicating a gift to the Buddhist order would suffice to ensure the fruitfulness of such a gift, it would be difficult to understand why elsewhere the discourses give so much importance to the ethical purity of a recipient of gifts. And Venerable Analia gives a number of parallels to that. In view of the absence of such a reference to the fruitfulness of giving to immoral monks in the parallel versions, it seems quite possible that this particular passage in the Dakina Vibhanga Sutta is a later addition to the discourse. The present reference thus could be reflecting the concerns of later generations of monastics to ensure constant supplies and therewith their safe survival amongst competing religious groups in ancient India, even in case some members of the Buddhist monastic community should not be able to maintain the proper standards of moral conduct. Which is a very bland and academic way of saying that it's a way of conning people into thinking even if you give to bad monks, you'll still get lots of merit. That's the suggestion. curiously enough, as a historical discussion, and this discussion is actually part of the Abhidhamma discussions about giving and merit and karma, and so it was a live issue within the Buddhist community, curiously enough, or perhaps one might think entirely predictably enough, exactly the same issue was discussed in the Catholic Church as well. Because when you belong to the Catholic Church, the key to the whole kind of Catholic structure is the idea that Jesus physically authorized the remission of sins and the entrance to heaven by his physical contact with the disciples after he rose, and through that physical contact then became appointed the physical lineage of ordinations, which became established as the Pope of Rome. And there's always a physical element to all those ordinations, meaning that every priest who's ordained according to that physical ordination, which goes from that same lineage, can then give absolution from sins and can guarantee a pathway to heaven, more or less. There's always a bit of wiggle room around that, but it seems so, by giving the Eucharist at the Mass. Of course, the question then arising, can a priest who themselves sins luxuriously, repeatedly, and joyfully, can they give the remission of sins? And this was a topic which was much debated in the Catholic Church, and the official answer is that they can, because the power comes to them through the institutional power of the Church as transmitted from Jesus, rather than from the individual qualities of the priest themselves. And so one can see, perhaps, if one were to be a little bit cynical, which of course wouldn't apply to anybody in this room, but if they were, then they might think that there was a similar requirement for the maintenance of expensive institutions in a time of declining conduct. Yes. Okay. After surveying the four purifications of gifts in similar ways, back to Venerable Anatta's study now. The Dakini Vibhanga Sutta, its Majjhima Agama parallel, the Gandhari fragment, the Tibetan version, all conclude with a set of stanzas on how a gift may be purified by the giver or by the recipient. Okay, so the individual translation instead, the list of verses is found in several versions, but not all of them. The individual translation, that's Satan's version, instead reports that on hearing this exposition on the merits of giving to the community, Mahapajapati Gotami decided to give the robe to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. Okay, so we've actually got we've got a proper ending on that one and not on the most of the others. Curious that Ananda doesn't really comment further on that. It was worthy of more analysis, but I can only presume that because he doesn't mention it, that she's not mentioned at the end of the other accounts similarly to the Pali.
And we have to know that she didn't get it to Bhikkhu and Bhikkhuni, so reinforces the idea that they were not Bhikkhunis.
Maybe, yeah, or maybe just weren't present at the time. But anyway, another curious little detail is that in addition to the Pali, which has five verses, Pali and the Gandhari fragment have five verses, then the Sarvasivadin, Majjhima Agama, and the Abhidharma Kaushupaka Namatika, once more agreeing with each other, both at a sixth verse, which is a praise of gifts made by slaves and the poor. Made by slaves and the poor, or to slaves and the poor? Huh. Oh, we have to check that out. I think it probably means made to slaves and the poor. For a translation of the six verses in that, and they're found in Thikmin Chao's book, which we have, we can check that out. I'd be interested to see that. I think it's probably a typo in Venerable Analio's book here. The Majjhima Agama 180 also differs from the Pali version by reporting the delighted reaction of Ananda and the assembled bhikkhus. Both of those things are standard features or recognized features differentiating the Pali from the Sarvastivadin canon. One feature being that where the Pali talks about giving to monastics, the Sarvastivadin texts also talk about giving to poor and people in need. And that's something which you find quite frequently mentioned and differentiating the two. The other thing which does differentiate the two is that whereas the Pali usually finishes with the pleased reaction of the listeners, usually the bhikkhus or whoever's listening to the sutta, it usually does, but occasionally it doesn't, as in this current sutta. In the Chinese version, the Sarvastivadin Madhyama Agama, it always finishes with the delighted reaction of the monks, even in a few cases, or the listener, even in a few cases where that seems somewhat implausible. For example, if the listener has died, then they're still recorded as having delighted in the discourse. back onto zombies again. Ananda's reaction is also mentioned in the Gandhari fragment. Okay. So that's the Dakinavibhanga Sutta. Aya Dhammananda. I thought you were going to say something. Yes. It always mentions the Bhikkhu Sangha first before the Bhikkhuni Sangha, but I'm not sure, quite sure what kind of hierarchy that you're mentioning, you're thinking of. In terms of offering, you mean? Or anything?
In terms of they're somehow, by putting in a certain order,
yeah,
you get more. Like implying there's more,
yeah,
better, that kind of implication. But not just mentioning one by one.
Yeah, but with that implication there, yeah. Could be.
And the quality of the monk's remaining.
I can't think of anything off the top of my head.
I'm thinking about it in the opposite way, of the negative karmic impact of harming on the basis of being in Sangha, or the negative effect of harming people at various stages of enlightenment. Mm-hmm. That is mentioned in some places.
And so I wonder then, is it always more horrific for someone's karma if this were true, then would it always be more horrific for somebody to kill a person just because they're a member of Sangha, like, you know, I'm of this religion, I hate you Buddhists, I'll kill you, versus killing an orphan?
Killing your parents, killing an arahant, seems to be roughly
equivalent. It does again. You have to say, you can certainly question that whole thing on the basis of normal ethics. You can say killing an arahant, well, they don't mind, for a start. And surely it's better to kill an arahant than it is to kill, a village of 1,000 innocent children or something like that. I don't know.
I mean, just the karmic whack for doing it could be actually much worse, just like killing your parents.
We shouldn't even be speculating.
I mean, I'm doing well, I killed hundreds of people, but it's just not the same as if you killed
his
mother.
I'm not expressing an opinion on it. I'm just saying that you can. It doesn't fit within the anywhere within the normal scale of sort of ethical values, you know? I mean, the normal scale of ethical values, you might think it's worse to kill a virtuous person, a good person, but you wouldn't necessarily think it was that much worse.
No, maybe it is. I mean, people have the idea that killing many animals is not nearly the same as killing a human being. Killing a human being is not nearly the same as killing your parents or an arahant. Killing the, you know, or drawing the blood of a Buddha. It's not like something foreign to the scriptures to have.
I'm not saying it's foreign to the scriptures. I'm just saying it's just different from a secular ethical point of view. Wouldn't evaluate it in the same way. I mean, normally I think if you evaluate Buddhist ethics, in most things, you know, it comes up pretty much the same as a secular ethical analysis would. But in that particular case, I don't think it does.
I'm not sure that it has to with images.
I'm not saying that it has to. I'm merely indicating that I don't think it does. That's all. Yeah.
Well, by ordinary ethics, killing your parents is not as bad as killing, you know, three people who you've never met. I mean, because one would be two and the other would be three. But by Buddhist ethics, it would be much, much worse.
Maybe, although if you were to look in from a different ethical approaches would approach that differently, and I think there would be some wiggle room there, but I think, you know, you would eventually reach a point where that would be true. Yeah, maybe not three people, maybe 1,000 people. You know, maybe not 1,000 people, maybe a country. Yeah.
But what if you say, like, I mean, who is your mother? The person who raised you, or the person who gave birth to you,
mm-hmm.
or the official person declared to be your mother? And then, uh-huh. What other beings in this samsara have been my mothers in the past? You know, can I kill anything without killing my mother?
Mm.
Then it becomes a bit difficult, doesn't it?
Well, it does. I do think it's talking about this life, but the point they mentioned is quite a valid one. That it's often, you know, who your mother is very often is not as clear as all that. Yeah, I mean, that's quite a normal situation.
But
yeah.
Your mother abused you, and then you got to a foster mother, and they treated you really well, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Five, 3 past 7.
Moral is sorry, all killing is
unwholesome. That's good, thanks for that, Marty. You captured that well. And giving is good.
Even to a sick person.
Even to a sick person. Yeah, okay, so let's finish up. And,
we've all missed that. Okay.